Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back with episode number 85 of our journey through our favorite 100 movies of all time. We're at number 16. So after this, it's a top 15, which is kind of wild, but we're at number 16 today, and I'm counting it as our last two 80s movies, even though John does have to reluctantly tell me that The Thing is an 80s movie. But let's be real, The Thing came out in 1982, and everybody knows that a decade doesn't really change over until, what, 2 or 3 years into it. So, like, the 80s actually go 83 to 92, and the 70s actually go 73. Well, 70s can just be 70 through 70s through 82.
Well, I think when it comes to the 80s, pretty much anything prior to Return of the Jedi counts as the 70s still.
See, I would argue it's Back to the Future. Oh, no. So Return of the Jedi was 83, right? Yeah, that was 83. Yeah, because I was thinking 86 for some reason. Yeah, no. So I'd say that's probably right. I'd say that's probably very fair. So we are into the 80s with Cinema Paradiso and Evil Dead 2. But they're two very different looking 80s movies. Obviously, Evil Dead 2 coming after the first Evil Dead and being a movie where clearly now they told him, hey, you can go make a movie with a budget. And like, not that it's much of a budget, but you can go actually make a movie rather than just like handheld camera sitting in the car doing whatever. And then Cinema Paradiso, which is just a love letter to movies from Giuseppe Tornatore, who really did nothing for throughout most of his throughout the rest of his career. So Fun look at 80s movies here. And then, yeah, I mean, I guess you can, I don't think you can say, so with a lot of the 80s movies that we had on this list, they really were like timeless classics, right? Timeless movies. I don't think you can call Evil Dead 2 timeless. And I don't mean that as a negative. I mean that as, it is very much a movie of its era, right? Like, this is not a movie that you would turn around and say, wow, like, if I watch this in 2087, like, I'm going to totally understand. Like, you need a backstory on Evil Dead 2 to sit down and watch Evil Dead 2, whereas I feel like a lot of the other ones that we had in this list from the 80s, like The Thing or like Cinema Paradiso, they don't really need an explanation for why they are what they are.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that kind of comes down to like the cult following that has made Evil Dead what Evil Dead is in general. Because like we're talking about a sequel that's also kind of like, it's kind of a requel, but it's more a sequel. And somehow both of the movies are canon in the universe. It's a weird experiment, but I think Evil Dead 2 is a perfect sequel.
Yeah, and a lot of people feel that way. A lot of people feel that way. And I will say that for what what it is. This isn't, it's kind of like when we watch anime, right? And I'm talking about like the hardcore anime. I'm not talking about Ghibli. I'm talking about Ghibli, however I'm supposed to say it. I only watched all the movies last year. I can't remember how to say it now. But I'm talking about I'm talking about Akira and like Evangelion and things like that. It's just not my genre. And I feel like this style of horror never really did it for me, even though I can appreciate it. And The Thing is a masterpiece. But Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, I always found them to be like, okay, I get it. I respect it. I appreciate it. Evil Dead 2, I find to be a huge improvement over the Evil Dead, though. And I think a lot of that just is the fact that Raimi really knew what he was able to do and what he was able to accomplish. And the one thing with Evil Dead 2 is, even for all of its, you know, campiness and everything, whether you like, if you don't like campiness, this movie's not going to work for you. But it is always fun. And I think that is the thing that a lot of horror movies nowadays don't have going for them. A lot of horror movies try so hard to do the slow burn and they don't all work. And I'm not about jump scares and things like that. I think that those were so overdone in the early 2000s. That it really ruined the horror genre for a long time.
A lot, yeah.
But I think we finally got back to that slow burn horror. But with the slow burn horror, they forget to be fun a lot of the time. And I think Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell and what they were able to do with Evil Dead 2 was just make a fun movie. And then they introduced the Southern guy in this movie. And all I could think about is Thanksgiving with the guy who's following, looking for Lassie. Where's Lassie? That's all I could think about because it just cracked me up that essentially the same character.
Yeah, no, absolutely. What Sam Raimi does with Evil Dead 2 is he takes this formula that he had for the first one. Because the first one was definitely an attempt to be a straight-up horror movie. And what Evil Dead 2 feels like to me, Sam Raimi realized, okay, there are some very comedic things when we do these kind of like low-budget effects and stuff. Because despite the fact that there's more of a budget, the effects in this are still pretty bad.
Yeah, they are.
They are, but they're great. They like they have a lot of character. We don't get like the oatmeal gushing out of body limbs in this one, but we just get like geysers of blood everywhere for no reason. And it's always a different color.
Yeah. And I'm all about the geysers of blood and things like that. I mean, when we do talk about the thing, I mean, there's so many parts of that now that don't hold up in terms of look, but that's kind of what makes it so damn good. Because it is that different kind of eerie, like that different kind of creepiness and horror that we don't see anymore. Like when the guy's head is attached to the beast, whatever you want to call it, we don't see that much anymore. Because now with CGI and things like that, and with these makeup departments able to pretty much do whatever they want. I just saw the trailer for Infinity Pool, the Alexander Skarsgård movie that's coming out. And it's just like, okay, how can we make a mask creepier and creepier and creepier and creepier and creepier? And that's all they're trying to do. And that's where with the Evil Dead 2, I do appreciate a lot of they knew their limitations. And I feel like they knew that with the Evil Dead, but the Evil Dead to me is just the reason why the Evil Dead, I think I gave it 2.5 stars when we watched it the last time or something like that. The reason why the Evil Dead lands there for me is because it's like soulless. There's no, yes, I understand that it was this cult movie. It was making it with severe limitations and all that, but it doesn't do it for me. There's no depth to it beyond that. Like I also look at what Tarantino did with Reservoir Dogs. He had a lot of limitations with that movie too. And it's pretty damn awesome. So I want the depth. And I feel like Evil Dead 2 goes there a little bit more, but Evil Dead 2 also has fun with it where they rush into the stuff, right? They go to the cabin. Why are we going here? It doesn't matter. Let's just get to the fun and games. And it's a quick watch, which is good because a lot of times now horror movies, especially after how the success of the Conjuring movies, they do end up being a little bit closer to the 2-hour mark than the hour and a half mark. And unless you're making psychological horror like Psycho or The Exorcist or something in that vein, a 2-hour horror movie is just too long, always. And that's what I really appreciate about Evil Dead 2 is it comes in, it gets its point across, it does what it has to, and it elevates the fun moments of the first one so significantly. I don't think I would give Evil Dead 2 any more than 3 stars ever. Just for my opinion, but it almost makes me want to give Evil Dead less stars because of how much more fun they're having with Evil Dead 2 than they are in the Evil Dead.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it comes down to the situation too, right? This is 6 years later. The first one was just some film school friends deciding they wanted to make a movie. The reason why Bruce Campbell was in the movie, because they just decided he was the best looking of them.
Mm-hmm. Which is crazy. He's not that good looking.
Oh, I mean, Bruce Campbell was very good looking. What are you talking about?
This he just wanted to get shot by his fangirls and boys too.
Oh, of course. This man's the pinnacle of B-movie, though, after this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't because of The Evil Dead. It's because of Evil Dead 2. Because what Sam Raimi really realized when he got into this film and he was making this film, they had to capitalize on Bruce Campbell and what Bruce Campbell was best at. And that is his physical comedy. His physical comedy is astounding in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every moment you get with him, he's just like, he's throwing himself around. And he feels like he's having a good time as he beats himself up. And it takes a really skilled actor to do what Bruce Campbell does in this movie.
Yeah, what I really like with this movie is when they go into the shed and there's the chalk outline of the chainsaw. And now, of course, that chainsaw scene has become so iconic when he uses it as his hand. But just to see the outline of the chalk and just think, what drugs were they on when they said, you know what, we're going to do an outline of a chainsaw so that he says chainsaw. So that chainsaw is in our minds, so that later in the movie, after he cuts his hand off, we're going to have a chainsaw like go as his hand. That's the kind of stuff that I'm talking about that the first Evil Dead just doesn't have. It's just missing those elements. And I guess the problem with the first Evil Dead was Sam Raimi was trying to be taken seriously. Yeah. And then that movie became such a cult hit that with Evil Dead 2, he already knew that he was going to be taken seriously. So now he could go and have a little bit more fun. Evil Dead 2 is so much more of what Sam Raimi would ultimately become than the first Evil Dead. Mm-hmm. I think it's night and day, because Evil Dead 2, that's pretty much how all of his movies go from there, right? Drag Me to Hell. Even if you start looking at the Spider-Man movies, like he knows the genre he's in, but he also knows how to put his own twist on a genre and his own humor into the genre. And I think that is where Evil Dead 2 really was like Sam Raimi's coming out party.
Yeah, and a lot of it just comes down to the fact that he works very close-knit with these people, right? Like, Bruce Campbell is in everything he does. He has a cameo in almost everything he does. He works with his brother Ted in almost everything. Ted, who is phenomenal as Henrietta in this film.
Okay, so he's Henrietta.
Yeah. It's this tight-knit group of people, these friends who are working together, and Sam Raimi's just having fun. And like you said, sometimes filmmakers, you can sit down and watch a movie, and even if it's a super serious movie, you can tell when a filmmaker is having fun doing it. We kind of talked about that when we were talking about The Fablemans a little while ago, with it felt like Spielberg was kind of having fun with making movies again, and we hadn't felt that from him in a while. And that's exactly what Evil Dead 2 is this is someone just embracing the fact, somebody decided to give me money to make another movie in this world that I created.
Yeah. And I wonder, I try to think about new directors who come out, right? Like new directors every time. Like we've been talking a lot about Charlotte Wells, and I haven't seen After Sun yet, but you talk about a movie like After Sun with Charlotte Wells, first time director, getting a lot of acclaim, right? And I think about that a lot now with first-time directors. We are having a hard time finding these, like, these really over-the-top directors, like, that used to come out of the woodwork all the time. David Lynch's first movie was Eraserhead. Yes. Sam Raimi's first movie is The Evil Dead. Like, Christopher Nolan's first movie is Following, which is just about a stalker. Like, very weird, different. Half of them are black and white, handheld cameras, didn't matter, whatever. And I feel like, and we're going to talk about this a lot with Cinema Paradiso, because the reason Cinema Paradiso is so high for me is because of its take on film. Mm-hmm. And I think that nowadays film has become such a business, and there are so many ways to get your films made nowadays because of Netflix and the other streaming services. You can throw stuff up on YouTube. Like, I have a friend who's been a DP on a whole bunch of stuff that is on YouTube. just on YouTube, and then all of a sudden it gets picked up by Amazon, and now that starts to change things. And like, those are, there's so many avenues now, but I feel like it's also making it so that people are a little bit more concerned about just being over the top outrageous with these movies, because, you know, the Daniels weren't able to make Everything Everywhere All at Once as their first movie. And I know they did Swiss Army Man, but they did Swiss Army Man at a time when independent film was still allowed to be really weird. And I feel like now independent film has gotten to the point of, it's more of really introspective rather than being weird. And Sam Raimi was obviously at the extreme of that weird when this happened. Yeah. I mean, and then you get to Wes Anderson in 97 or 98, whenever the hell he made Bottle Rocket. And it's not nearly as weird as a Sam Raimi, but it's still weird. It's still not a very like straightforward movie. And I know After Sun's not totally straightforward, but all of this just getting to the point of, because of what the film industry has become, I don't know if we're going to see people taking the types of chances and just being outrageous with their first films the way that somebody like Sam Raimi was.
Yeah, you're right. And it's kind of unfortunate, because as much as we really like high caliber, like thought-provoking film, we also like fun film. That's why a movie like Evil Dead 2 can be 16th in my top 100 films of all time list. Because I first saw this movie in, grade 11 or something like that. I talked about it when I first watched the first Evil Dead. It was on YouTube in 11 parts. And this one, I watched it all and I fell in love with it because I love what they did, what Sam Raimi did with this. I love how he took a world and he expanded it. And this is what I was getting at when I said this is a perfect sequel. Sequels, I think you can have sequels in two different ways. Sequels are a successor to a story or an episode of a continuing story. So if you look at something like the Scream franchise, each one of those movies has been another episode, right? You kind of need to see the previous movie to kind of get an idea of what's going on, right? Like the Star Wars movies. If you're not watching the first one in a trilogy, you kind of have to see what happens first to understand what's going on. You don't need to do that with Evil Dead 2. It's a spiritual successor, as much as it's like retconning kind of what happens in the first movie. And again, Sam Raimi in further productions has undone that retcon and made this so it's like, they kind of both bleed into each other now. It's really confusing when you get into the like what's
which is why I don't
in Evil Dead, but it's worth it because this franchise is one of the it's I thought about it this week. It's my favorite horror franchise because it has absolutely everything. It has that low budget first horror movie. It has the Evil Dead 2, which is like this pinnacle of slapstick horror. It has Army of Darkness, which is like this action adventure movie. It has a musical, which is has some of the worst songs you'll ever listen to, but is so fun. It has a three-season TV show that continues the story from Evil Dead 2. It has the 2013 remake, which is an actual, factual, like, straight-up horror movie, which is great. And it has another movie coming out this year. Like, this franchise has grown so much, and it shouldn't have. Like, this is a franchise that people were forgotten. It was relegated to YouTube in 11 parts. But now we have, like, this cult following. It's so big that we get to follow this franchise and we get to see the evolution of it. Because in the first movie, we don't really get explanations as to what's really going on. We know there's some tape recorder. These words are said. Something starts possessing everyone. Everyone starts dying. In this movie, we get that preface. We get the you know, Necronomicon Ex Mortis, the Book of the Dead. That opening we get to this movie. And it puts everything kind of into perspective. It takes this world that was so self-contained and didn't need answers and flushes it out deeper and deeper. And it even lays the groundwork for what's to come when we get that part in the movie when Annie shows up with the extra pages and they're going through it. And it shows Ash in medieval times. Like, that is a ridiculous concept. But that actually happens and there's an entire movie dedicated to it.
Oh, I know. I know. And I love that ending. I mean, I think that ending is a lot of fun because it's everything that they're talking about is what he becomes. You know, he's the hero fallen from the sky or whatever it is who takes on the demons. And I think that's fun. I think that's a really fun ending. And that's where I give Evil Dead 2 so much more credit than the first Evil Dead, because the first Evil Dead, like, it just ends, you know, like it just ends. And, you know, obviously this really was that cabin in the woods type genre, which Evil Dead was kind of the, you know, the beginning of that, or it had been happening a little bit before that in the 70s, but the Evil Dead is really the one that's now become the iconic version of that. I don't know. I like everything that Raimi mixes in Evil Dead 2 to create kind of this weird world where, you know, anything kind of seems possible and you don't know what's going to come next. And this is a movie that doesn't actually, at least I haven't seen much, try to be copied all that much, because I think it is so unique and so of its time that you might try to follow the same plot line of Friends Go to the Woods or Cabin Fever, like the Eli Roth movie and all of that. But very few times will you see somebody actually trying to emulate what Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell are doing in this movie, unless they are doing a full-blown spoof like Thanksgiving, where it's like, oh no, we gotta kill the book. I mean, really, if you watch Evil Dead 2 and then watch Thanksgiving the next day, it's almost the exact same movie.
Yeah, it's a formula that works, especially when you're doing this like schlocky slapstick aspect of it, which is why this movie is so much better than the original in my eyes. It's because it just embraces what it is. Because the first movie kind of gets made fun of for the fact that, like, Ash ends up under a bookcase twice in that movie somehow. Uh-huh. And is the person to survive.
Yeah.
Like, from every horror standpoint, it doesn't make sense that Ash is the person to survive that film. But he does. And then Evil Dead 2, we take that premise. Okay, he survived. He's coming here with, whether it's the same Linda or another Linda that he just decided to date and decided to go back to a cabin again. Whatever the take is you want to take with the beginning of this movie, because it's clearly a sequel. It's named Evil Dead 2. But that first half hour of the film where it's retconning that the first movie, so that it's just Linda, and it adds so much more emotional weight to it, despite the fact that there's like no dialogue in that first half of the movie. Mm-hmm. Because we just see, because Bruce Campbell is such a great facial actor, because he's showing us. And a lot of it comes down to the fact that we see this descent of the descent into madness that Ash Williams goes through after just having murdered his girlfriend.
Yeah, I know. I love that. I love all that. And yeah, I mean, I don't put too much thought into the opening of this movie where it's, you know, is it a direct sequel? What is it? Blah, blah, blah. I feel like that's one of those where, again, it was the 80s, and I think that they all said, who cares? Nobody's going to think about this. Nobody's going to dissect this. Because back in, you know, again, back in 1987, people weren't dissecting movies the way that we sit here and dissect them today. And, you know, that's going to be a huge topic of conversation in the second half hour of this podcast. But you can't predict what's going to come in the future. And that's why I always like looking back and, you know, in retrospect, Dances with Wolves is a bad movie, according to a lot of people. But in 1990, Dances with Wolves was incredible. Like, it was an incredibly well-made movie. They didn't know what was going to end up becoming of the feel of those types of movies. And I feel like the same could be said for Evil Dead 2, where they just sat down and said, who cares? It's the sequel. People liked the first one. People will go see this. We know we're going to put butts in seats at theaters. That's all that matters. Who cares what the first 20 minutes are? Nowadays, they would over-explain that to death to try to make it make sense. I mean, we see it. The biggest problem, and it's George Lucas's fault, the biggest problem is now when something doesn't make sense, or when they don't appreciate it or whatever, they go back and they change it. And it's total bullshit. You know, if the Mona Lisa wasn't perfect, you can't go back and change a brushstroke on the Mona Lisa now. Like, and I feel like we keep seeing Stranger Things just got a whole bunch of crap for it because they were changing things throughout theirs. Throughout their earlier seasons, I think they cut out a plot line or put in something new to make something make sense because of fan reaction or something. And it's nonsense. That shouldn't be happening. But we're starting to see that happen more and more because people are so worried about being nitpicked and they give into the audience too much. You know, Game of Thrones is a great example of that. They didn't change things, but they gave into the audience so much that by the end of that show, the writers had no control over the show that they were writing. It was being written by the audience, and any decision they made that the audience wasn't happy with, they, you know, they were screwed. They were doomed because they had given in so much. Sam Raimi wasn't giving in. Sam Raimi was just making a movie and saying, you're going to be entertained by this. And if you're not entertained by it, that's your problem. So you can sit there and you can, you know, for the problems I see with the Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, I would never sit there and say, well, the opening of Evil Dead 2 doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? And I feel like there are people out there, though, who would say that as a way to tell you, John, that Evil Dead 2 does not belong at number 16.
See, I feel there are people like that. There are definitely people like that. But I feel like the Evil Dead fandom is so forgiving of it on a level that you don't see in any other fandom. And I think it's because Sam Raimi embraced it. In Ash vs. the Evil Dead, which is the Starz TV show that came out, they make reference to both Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2 in the film. Like, things that happen in that TV show are related to the events that happen in both of these movies, and they are both acknowledged in the TV show. No explanation going in about it, but essentially what it feels like is that Sam Raimi just took the continuity that the musical made, where the first act of the musical is Evil Dead 1, and, like, the act break is with Ash chainsawing Linda.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the cast of Evil Dead 2 minus Bobby Joe enter the cabin, and that's the act break. And then act 2 is just Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
And, like, that's what the decision has been made in this. And the fact that Sam Raimi was able to do that with this and still make this opening 20 minutes so memorable because of this claymation dancing scene with Linda is incredible.
That it's claymation so dancing scene is so weird.
Oh, it's so haunting, though. It really sets the tone for the rest of this film, in my opinion. Because, like, it's not the first scary thing, obviously. The first scary thing is Linda popping up and being possessed and, like, Ash slapping her head off with the shovel and everything. And then we get the, the camera zoom, right? And attacking him and him, you know, waking up as being possessed and everything. And then we get this weird dancing scene, and it leads to the point where, you know, he wakes up, we're not sure if it's a dream or not, and then Linda's head pops into his lap and bites him. And it's so fantastic because it is exactly what this film is, because you're not supposed to know if Ash is just going crazy or if this stuff's actually happening, and we don't really get that confirmation until the rest of the cast comes into the movie.
Which is fun, too, because it's also not a movie that's trying to be a psychological thriller. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it asks that question very vaguely on a very surface level. It's not sitting here saying, look at this man's descent into madness. It still has a silly tone to it, which, again, I think is missing. And from a lot of newer horror movies, and I'm not saying I like serious horror. That's the best kind of horror, the descent and things like that. Those are the best kinds. But there's really not a world anymore for this Evil Dead 2, because even Drag Me to Hell wasn't that well received. I mean, it has, like, a pretty good Rotten Tomatoes score, but if you look at audience reviews of Drag Me to Hell, it's not that well received, because audiences in 2009 or whatever year that came out didn't have that same hunger for this type of movie. And I don't think you're really going to see, you don't see these types of movies anymore. Like I said, they really are trying to take themselves seriously. You're not going to get a scene of a dancing headless whatever anymore, because it's going to be seen as too corny and too cheesy, but it's still really freaking creepy.
Yeah. And, like, that's what makes Evil Dead 2 so perfect. It's because it can't be replicated. It's because you mentioned Drag Me to Hell. And not this past year, but the year before, I said it was my most disappointing movie of the year because Sam Raimi didn't go full Sam Raimi in that movie. He was too conservative in that film, and he didn't decide if he wanted to go the, like, pure horror route, which he had been making beforehand, because, like, that was in his, like, let's remake The Grudge phase of life and everything, or if he wanted to go back to, like, this era of Sam Raimi, this late 80s, early 90s era. And that's what was missing from that film. And what you have here is that unsettlingness. And then every scene that happens afterwards, every time you're laughing, you're not sure if you're supposed to be laughing, mm-hmm. right? And like, you get that scene where Ash is talking in the mirror and then his reflection grabs him and is like,
yeah,
you just killed your girlfriend. We are not fine. And mm-hmm. then it's just him grabbing himself. And then we find out his hand's possessed and he cuts off his hand and he puts it in a bucket and puts Farewell to Arms on top of it.
Yeah.
If that's not just having fun, I don't know what is.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was a nice touch that he put a Farewell to Arms. Yeah. I mean, again, like, oh, I'm going to sneeze. So you talk.
And then you even have this other additional cast you get here. I like the fact that Sam Raimi narrows down the beginning of this film to focus primarily on Ash. And I mean, mm-hmm. to some extent, Linda, but like Linda's a prop in this movie. Let's be real.
Yeah.
And then we get this rest of this cast who he set it up where all of a sudden, instead of it being some abandoned cabin, this is the cabin of a scientist and his family. Mm-hmm. And they're all coming there, or like a historian, not a scientist.
Historian, yeah.
And they're all coming there. Linda makes the mention of, what if they come back? Oh, don't worry about that. They're not going to. It makes Ash a lot more carefree than he was in the first movie, which is a way better character because carefree Ash is hilarious.
Yeah.
And then you have these other archetypes that come in that aren't really characters. Like, Annie's kind of a character, but she's kind of like this, like, generic female character who's like maybe a love interest. Now that Linda's dead, maybe not, is kind of unclear. You have Jake, who's this massive hillbilly stereotype. Ed's in it for like a scene, so much so that you probably didn't even know his name was Ed.
Yeah, I didn't until I put my mouse over it on Letterboxd and it said Ed over the one guy's name.
And then Bobby Joe is essentially there just so we can have another tree rape scene.
Yeah, because that one was very successful the first time around.
Of all, I mean, at least this one was like less rapey and more like, mm-hmm. okay, this tree is killing you. But man, Sam Raimi, of all the things to continue to keep in both films, bold choice.
Again, something that people weren't concerned was going to be a problem in 2000 and whatever, because in 1987, that was the time. I mean, you got to think, what, how many years after the house, last house on the left was this?
What, that movie came out in 74?
Oh, that was all the way back in 72. But anyway, you had all these movies that, you know, we were talking about it with, what do you call it? Streetcar Named Desire last week, where, you know, that movie had to be so careful about rape. And then in the 70s and the 80s, it was, okay, how egregious can we make this? And, you know, thankfully that has died down significantly. But in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you will see much more significant stuff. And then you have a movie like Irreversible, which I think pretty much was the breaking point of all of that. And then from there, it just went down. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Irreversible, but it is one of the most egregious, like, just, I don't even know if egregious is the right word, but it is heinous. Is that the word? It is a like 5-minute rape scene where there is no cut and it is uncomfortable. It's Gaspar Noé, however the hell you say his last name.
All of a sudden, this makes a lot of sense.
Doesn't it make so much more sense? But I feel like that was a breaking point where people were like, okay, thanks for the shock value. Also, let's stop putting that on film to be entertained.
Yeah, I'm glad we're at that point now.
Yeah, I agree.
But, I mean, before we finish up with Evil Dead 2, like, there is these little things. Like, I love the basement scene. I love Henrietta, like, singing the lullaby, and then it coming around again where Annie's singing it to distract Henrietta at the end. I love Jake trying to run away from Eel Ash and getting stabbed as he opens the door. It's hilarious. And then them not being able to close the door because his corpse is lying in the way.
So yeah, funny. I know. The Henrietta stuff was fun. That was like another touch because that's kind of a callback to the first one, but not with exact being the first one. So making it have a little bit more purpose, I guess.
Yeah. And this last sequence, they just took like stock armor sequence and like superimposed Bruce Campbell into the scenes, right? Because it's sure like that when I watched it this week.
For the night stuff?
Yeah.
No, they're definitely there reacting to him. They definitely are. Yeah.
I don't know. It looked kind of
I just don't think it looks very good.
There's the scene where it switches to night, and you can see, like, the cutout of the moon that they're using in the backdrop, and it felt like that to me.
I don't know. I feel like there's too much interaction with what's actually taking place on screen for them to just be pulling
That's possible.
Yeah.
But it could just be, I don't know, it might just be dubbed over. I don't know. Speculation on my part. I should probably look into it.
Before you start spreading lies about poor Sam Raimi.
I respect it, Sam Raimi.
Now, I do want to say this, though, John, just because you've already said that you're going to change it, but you have this ahead of Casablanca, and that's just a problem for me, okay?
It is a problem. And actually, Evil Dead 2 probably slides down just a little bit down my list, but I'm always going to have fun. I'm always up to watch this movie. It's just so much
fun.
I mean, there's only one word that really describes this movie, right?
Evil? Dead?
Groovy.
Groovy. That is so yes, groovy. All right. Well, John and I, neither one of us managed to watch another movie other than Evil Dead 2 and Cinema Paradiso over the last week, which is crazy for the two of us. So with Oscar nominations coming out on Tuesday, January 24th, we decided that we are going to try to predict the 10 best pictures or just give our take on what the 10 are going to be. Last year was the first time that it was officially like had to be 10 since like 2012 or something like that. There was a period where they were doing it had to be 10 movies, and they went to it could be anywhere between 5 and 10, and now they're back to officially 10, mainly because they're trying to give an excuse to nominate shitty movies as much as they can. But, John, with the 10 movies that are being nominated, there's four that I think are absolute 100% locks, and those are Banshees, Everything Everywhere, Fablemans, and Tar.
Yeah, I agree.
Those are 100% going to be nominated. If they didn't get nominated, it's because somebody dies or does something inappropriate between. Voting closed yesterday. So actually, at this point, there's nothing that can be done. Those movies are being nominated. Those four are locks. I feel like Elvis is probably as close to a lock as you can be without being a lock. It got the PGA nom. It's been getting a whole bunch of noms. Like, I feel like it's there. After that, I kind of feel like I know where this is going, but I'm curious to hear your take because the PGA nominations were disappointing to say the least. The PGA nominations had Avatar, The Way of Water, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, Glass Onions and Knives Out Mystery, and Top Gun Maverick. Now, I really enjoyed Top Gun Maverick. Yeah, I really enjoyed Top Gun Maverick. I didn't like Glass Onion. I didn't see the other two yet. So take from me what you will. But to nominate four sequels to movies that had like that were already in the cultural whatever. Knives Out was obviously very popular. Whodunit? First Avatar was the favorite to win Best Picture and didn't. Black Panther was the first Marvel movie nominated for Best Picture. Whoop the F and do. And then you have Top Gun Maverick, which is really well done, but still has the fame of the original Top Gun. Four of those movies in the same year just seems egregious to me. It just seems, and that's the second time I've now used that word, but that is way too much, right? Like, am I going crazy? Are the Oscars going to nominate all four of those?
I only have one of them on my list of what I think is going to be the nominations. I only have one. And unfortunately,
I have two of them. I don't have all four, but I do have two.
Okay. There was one that was like my borderline. I'll say it now. Top Gun was kind of my borderline where it could make it, but I felt like it probably wasn't going to. The one I have on my list is Avatar Way of Water, just because, I don't know, everyone seems to like James Cameron despite the fact that he seems like the biggest asshole out there.
Yeah, it's like nobody likes him, but they like him. It makes no sense. Yeah. So here's my thing. I think Avatar will get it. But I think Maverick is – I have Maverick right below Elvis. So I think Maverick is the sixth most likely movie to be nominated. And my main reason for that is the DGA nominated Joseph Kosinski. And Joseph Kosinski got the nomination with Todd Field, the Daniels, Martin McDonagh, and Steven Spielberg. To me,
those are some names.
The DGA is – normally the guilds pretty much tell you who's going to be nominated and who's going to win for each of the major awards. If the DGA is nominating Joseph Kosinski – and there's 10 movies being nominated for Best Picture, Maverick is getting in. So I think Top Gun Maverick is in. I think Avatar Way of Water will limp over the line. I don't think Black Panther Wakanda Forever is weird to me. I won't watch that movie unless it gets nominated or unless me and John put me through torture. But I don't think Glass Onion is going to get across the finish line here. And my main reason is All Quiet on the Western Front just killed it at the BAFTA with the BAFTA nominations. And I think that's going to be the Netflix movie that gets the Oscar nomination for Best Picture as kind of a shocker that suddenly has become less shocking. But if you would have said this, you know, 3 weeks ago, everybody been like, All Quiet on the Western Front has no shot. I think that's going to be the one that limps across the finish line. So that's 8 of my 10. And then I have 2 more, but what else do you have on there?
So it's interesting you mentioned All Quiet on the Western Front. It was because one of the spots I was considering, it's very like we're at a point now where you can't have one of these best international films not make the best picture noms when there's 10 of them. Like it's just impossible because you're saying that these other 10 movies are better than this movie that won a category.
Mm-hmm.
So I did end up going with Argentina 1985 over it.
Okay.
But I think it's kind of a toss-up between the two of them.
Yeah, I think All Quiet will get the nod because more people will watch All Quiet. I think that'll ultimately put it over the line.
All Quiet concerns me because it's essentially a remake, right? Like,
but what about Triple R? Do you think Triple R has any shot?
I don't know. A lot of people really liked it, but is it what the Academy's looking for?
That's what I think too. That's why I go with All Quiet on the Western Front. They love war movies.
So
and that's their only shot to really. I know Top Gun Maverick is a war movie. It's not a war movie. I think that's why All Quiet on the Western Front will ultimately get pulled over the line there because I think they love war movies and that's a war movie.
Speaking of things the Academy loves, I have The Whale on my list because they love Aronofsky.
Yeah, see, I don't have The Whale making it. It did get a PGA nomination, but I think it's going to miss out here. It hasn't gotten many other nominations. The one that I think will end up getting in that really was a shocking omission to me, and I haven't seen the movie, so maybe I shouldn't be super shocked, but just based on the buzz it was getting and everything, was Women Talking. And Women Talking not getting a nomination at the PGA for those 4 sequels that we just mentioned, I thought was very surprising. And I think that Women Talking will get the nomination because it really is – between that and After Sun, those are the 2 movies right now that you could nominate that have a female director attached to them. And Women Talking feels like the more sure bet out of those 2, even though I think After Sun, I do have After Sun as my 10th movie, but it's going to come down to After Sun and I think Wakanda Forever for that 10th spot.
See, I also have After Sun on there because, quite frankly, like, I think it was the best made movie of the year. Like I do have Everything Everywhere All at Once above it in my like what was good this year, but like barely. Like those movies are like 1-2 right after each other, and then it's a big gap before we hit 3 this year. I put Triangle of Sadness on my list simply because Hollywood loves to still put those movies about rich people being bad in their nominations, and I think they put Triangle of Sadness over Glass Onion.
See, I would be all about it. I haven't seen Triangle of Sadness either, and I plan on getting to all of these shortly, but Triangle of Sadness is one that I could definitely see getting in there as well over After Sun. I think it's just going to come down to, really, I think the top 7, Banshees, Everything Everywhere, Fablemans, Tar, Elvis, Maverick, and Way of Water are all get nominated, and then it's going to come down to the movies that I think are in contention are Women Talking, All Quiet on the Western Front, After Sun, Wakanda Forever, The Whale, She Said, I think still has a little bit of a shot because it really is kind of like spotlight for women.
Yeah.
And then what was the other one? And then Glass Onion, maybe. But I think Glass Onion would be a really lazy nomination. I mean, I agree. As somebody who really disliked Black Panther, I think Wakanda Forever is probably a better nomination than Glass Onion, just because Glass Onion is for that to be the first Rian Johnson movie nominated for Best Picture.
Oh,
yeah.
That's rough.
I don't like that. Like, I just don't like that. Like, Rian Johnson has made a lot of good movies. And I think that he that should not be the first one that gets nominated. I think that's a cop out. Like, and I know you gave Glass Onion a much better review than I did, but I like Glass Onion is just not a best picture movie to me.
Yeah,
and,
I agree.
And I didn't really like it, but I don't think it's a best picture movie. Even if I did like it, it just doesn't make sense.
I mean, arguably, like Everything Everywhere All at Once isn't a best picture movie either. I think what a best picture movie is changing now. Mm-hmm. And the Academy is still trying to figure out what that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, did you say all 10 of yours?
I did say all 10 of mine, yeah.
Okay. All right. We're moving on to Cinema Paradiso from 1988, which is my number 16. What I truly believe is the greatest love letter to movies ever put on film. I think a beautiful movie. Ennio Morricone's score is devastating. Really the only movie Giuseppe Tornatore ever did that anybody really watched. He's made a couple other movies, but this is by far and away the only one that people talk about. You know, to me, this is just one of those movies that really changed my perspective on things. I watched this movie for the first time before I moved to Los Angeles. Was literally like 2 days before I was about to get in the car and drive. Watched it with my dad, wanted to go. I was going to go out to LA. I was going to make movies. Instead, I'm sitting here talking about them living in South Florida, right? Like that's the difference. But never give up that hope, right, John? But the thing is, what I loved about this movie is just the appreciation for film and how it's able to get all of that across without outwardly telling you how important film is, right? Like you haven't seen Babylon yet, but Babylon literally has a scene where Brad Pitt is talking about how important film is. This movie is 2 hours of telling you how important film is without getting into it, you know, with dialogue. And this, what killed me with this, because I've always loved movies. That's what made me want to go work in Hollywood. And then I got to Hollywood and realized there's a lot of people there who just hate movies. They just hate movies. They just want to be famous and they hate movies. That's all it is. And the scene where they're all fighting to get in and it's wall to wall, people in awe watching this movie. Mm-hmm. And now the people outside are so pissed that they can't get in because people have already seen it twice and they're looking. So he puts it out on the wall for them. One of the most beautiful scenes of the movie, which is then followed by, you know, him going blind. That to me is what film is. Film was always intended to be an escape. Now, whether that meant you escaped in a way like The Deer Hunter, where it talks about Vietnam and it's super depressing. Or Lost in Translation about two people who have no idea where their lives are going and it's depressing. Or Evil Dead 2, where it's just a slash them up, whatever's going to happen, doesn't matter, like horror movie, horror comedy. Whatever the movie was going to be, it was always intended as a way of escape. The guy who goes in there to go to sleep because he can relax in this movie theater. We sit here and we talk about movies. And while I'll always sit here and say, you know, I don't like Marvel movies or I don't like this or I don't like that. What we always try to do when we talk about these movies is talk about them in a positive way, even if we don't really like them, right? Like even if there's something that we hated, talk about why we didn't like it, but also what's the merit behind this movie? Because at the end of the day, movies weren't intended to entertain and to create this world that you couldn't be in. And we see it in Cinema Paradiso so beautifully, set against the backdrop of war and communism and people not knowing if their loved ones are going to come home and all of those things. But they're all together when they go into this movie theater and they're all dying to see what's going to happen. And I feel like we've just gotten to this point in society. This is why this movie is the reason, it is the reason why I do not watch things that I don't think I'll like. This movie is pretty much the reason why I stopped watching Marvel movies when I decided I wasn't getting much out of them other than why am I going to the theater to see these every time. It's why there's like, I will wait until Avatar The Way of Water gets nominated for Best Picture to sit down and watch that movie. because some people love that guy who I was talking about, who's a total clown on Letterboxd, who wrote that review about Chazelle with Babylon. He loves to sit there and hear himself talk and rip apart other people's work. But he already knew he was going to hate that movie when he went into it. So why? Yeah. And we've hit this point as a society where it's like, it's our right to hate things because it doesn't go 100% the way that we want them to go. Entertainment, whatever. You know, like I said with Game of Thrones earlier, it wasn't good anymore because of blah, 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 blah. We've all become R.L. Stein with these choose-your-own-adventure endings. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I think Cinema Paradiso just captures the heart and soul of the beauty of film and why people are so obsessed with film in general. Because you watch a movie and after it's over, you want to talk to people about it. Did you like it? Did you not like it? Whatever, blah, blah, blah. But you want to talk about it. It's so important because when you're talking about that movie, you are removing yourself from whatever your situation is, from all the problems you're having and all of those things. And I don't think a movie will ever capture the power of film better than the way Cinema Paradiso captures it. It is a beautiful, beautiful portrayal. And this was a movie that was in the IMDb top like 50 or whatever it was. And I was always like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'm sure. Like, you know, when you read what it's actually about, it doesn't sound all that interesting, but it's really not about anything. Salvatore, Toto, whatever, and Alfredo, their friendship is throughout this, but this movie is about the magic of film and how, as you get older, that magic kind of goes away because you try to imprint it into your real life. And that's not how it is. And that magic just starts to disappear. But when you go back to it, it's always there. The nostalgia of film, what you felt when you watched a movie for the first time. That's why we're doing this top 100 list. A lot of these movies that are in our top 20, it's because of how they made us feel the first time we watched them. I can't wait to watch Lost in Translation again because I'm going to be back in high school sitting there watching that movie at like 11:45 at night and being like, holy shit, this movie just devastated me. And that's what Cinema Paradiso is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. When I sat down to watch this the other day and I got about 20 minutes in, so you're about the point where like all that crowd's going into the theater, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I don't know if I like this movie that much. Nothing's really happening. There's no real depth to these characters. Like, I understand what they're going for, but like, I don't know if I'm getting it. And then it shows this shot of that couple making eye contact for the first time. And like, at that point, it's like, oh, I get what this movie is about. This movie isn't about the characters. It's about what the Paradiso stands for and what it means to all these people and what it provides and what movies provide to everyone. And I was like, okay, now I'm really digging this movie. I got really into it. And then, you know, the fire happens and then they reopen the Paradiso afterwards. And the priest comes in and he's like blessing it. And I'm like, oh my God, let's talk about movies as a religion. I start sobbing uncontrollably. I can't stop because I just realize how important that message is to me as a person, because that is exactly how I feel about films. This watching a movie, and like some people don't get it, but we get it. The people, all of you listening to us talk about movies over and over again, you all get it. Movies are so much more than just this images on a screen associated with sound. They are escapism. They're emotion. They're feeling. They connect us with ourselves and with other people all at the same time. And they're so, it's so profound. And that's exactly what Cinema Paradiso is showing in this moment. And it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. And I think like, It always is, right? Like you, what are the things that from your childhood that were the most important or the best or whatever it is, right? Like, you know, what toys did you play with? What video games did you play? What friends did you have? What did you and your friends do when you were growing up? You know, that's what this movie is getting at, right? I said it's the happier version of Last Picture Show, because Last Picture Show is the this is a depressing town, and without the picture show, it all falls apart and these people are hopeless. And in this movie, yeah, it's a depressing town. It's the small town. Everybody's, you know, struggling for work and struggling to eat and blah, blah, blah. But there's a positive spin on all of that because it is being told from the perspective of a man who did succeed in a lot of ways in his life and is remembering all of these good times that he had, whether it be with Alfredo or Elena or whoever it is. It's what he's remembering. It's that the relationships that he built, and he's seeing them through these rose colored glasses, because that's how we view nostalgia. And Alfredo says it in this movie, don't come back. Don't let nostalgia win, because so often we do. And you can't go back to a lot of these places because, you know, it's the same thing. Do you miss your hometown or do you miss being a child? Do you miss your ex-girlfriend or do you miss how old you were when you were dating your ex-girlfriend? Do you know what I mean? Like, what are you actually missing? And I think that's what this movie gets to. I know you and I, we were texting about Elena's character because you were not into that. And I'll obviously let you talk about that. But the one thing I realized, because then I watched it a full day after you had had that discussion with me, and what I really felt with that character was it wasn't so much about her. It wasn't so much about his love for Elena. It was that he never, even with all the successes he had with his career, that feeling of first love, like his first love was the film, was movies. And that stuck with him in some way. But his first love with a person, he was never able to replicate again. It's a different girl every time and all that. And I think there's something so profound about when he's watching the clips of her at the end, because he's not missing Elena. He's missing being that young, hopeful boy who is going to take the world by storm and is going to have one of those movie type love stories and is going to do all these great things. That's what he's missing. And there's not many movies that can hit on so many different levels a very basic love story, mm-hmm. the way Cinema Paradiso does. That's just my opinion, but that's what I was thinking when I was watching it tonight.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. I get the purpose of it. To me, in the moment, it felt like Elena was this tool to get to the point where Alfredo tells Toto not to come back. That mm-hmm. That's how I felt about it. And even now, like, I'm reflecting on it now, and it's like, I didn't dislike it as much mm-hmm. in retrospect, especially now that I'm thinking a lot more on the story Alfredo tells Toto about mm-hmm. about the soldier sitting there outside the princess's balcony for 99 days and then leaves before the 100th. It's that idea that once you obtain something, like, it's not going to be as good as you've made it in your mind at that point, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that's the big thing that, like, film does. I mean, let's be honest here. Film's given a lot of people some pretty bad romantic advice over the last century.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah. You watch films and you, like, see these grandiose gestures and stuff. That's not what romance is. It can be for some people, but for the average person, like, that's just kind of creepy. Or, like, over the top and not something that people really appreciate. And I do like the Elena plot because it's like this lost love. I just kind of wish the film gets back. And it gets there. It gets there at the end, mm-hmm. but it doesn't quite get there to the point where it's like, but that doesn't matter because I have film.
Yeah. And I get what you're saying, because it really is like a love letter to film, but I feel that what this movie does is it shows the power of film, the love for film, the things that film can do for a little kid in this town where his father's been killed in war and mm-hmm. he's poor and all that. And this old man who's too stupid to do anything else, but he can give this beauty to people, right? And all these desperate people, like how important film is. And then when it burns and Alfredo loses his sight, Alfredo's still positive through a lot of that, but we see the struggles as Toto gets older. When Toto's a kid, mm-hmm. we don't really see the struggle. It seems, oh, it's all good. But as he gets older, we start to see those struggles and those issues and whatever. But I think like there's so many layers to what Tornatore was saying with this, yeah. But I think what it really comes down to is it's the loss of that childhood innocence, wonder, all of those things. And how as we get older, it is just, it's a corruption after a corruption after a corruption mm-hmm. after a corruption, because life doesn't actually go the way movies go. In a movie, if you're introduced to a character, that character is going to play some sort of impactful role in your protagonist's life. We're all the protagonist of our own lives, and we're introduced to so many characters who don't mean shit, right? Or who act a certain way that has lasting repercussions. And I think for him, it was that dream world, right? Toto was living in this dream world of the movies and all of that. And that's what he was going to make movies. He was so inspired that he was going to make movies. And then he met this girl, and this girl became more important until she never got off that bus. And that her not getting off the bus is the major turning point in this movie, because by her not getting off that bus, it corrupts him to real life for the rest of his life. But he's still making movies, right? He is so successful making movies. Alfredo says, I don't want to hear from you. I want to hear about you. And they're all talking about how busy he is. His mother has to go through his assistant. He hasn't been home in 30 years. All of those things. Because when she didn't get off that bus, that movie love, that fictitious love you see so often on screen, no longer existed for him. So to cope with it, he continues to date girls who are barely older than Elena is in that movie. When he breaks up with her or whatever, when she doesn't get off the bus, and he lives in his dream world with the movies. Mm-hmm. It's very devastating. It's just very depressing, but in a nostalgic, beautiful way, because so often that is what happens. I think about the end of La La Land, which was clearly inspired by the ending of this, right? Where they imagine their whole lives playing out. And this kissing scene at the end of the movie, I have the poster in my living room of all the kisses. It's literally each film strip of the kisses. Boom, 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 right down. It's a poster. It's great. And that kissing scene is so emotional and so impactful, because those things that were taken out because of the time, right? Before the innocence again. And then after it burns down the first time, it's that loss of innocence, because now the mob is essentially running the Cinema Paradiso. And it's Don Ciccio, and they're doing all this stuff. And they have the prostitute working in the back room of the movie theater, and they're showing kissing and sex and violence and whatever in the movies. It's that loss of innocence. And then the kisses are such a basic thing, but it is the most nostalgic part, because it reminds you of a time when that wasn't okay, when it was a simpler time. Even though the times were difficult as anything, it still was a simpler time, because people would sit down and watch the movie and everybody go, oh, we're never going to see them kiss. We're never. And then you do see them kiss, right? And it's exactly what you said earlier. And you've built it up so much in your head that it really doesn't mean anything at that point.
Yep. Yeah, except for those five boys who are jerking off to.
Oh, my God. And then the best, though, is when the guy walks down and he looks at him, he slaps the kid, and then he looks up at the screen and he fixes himself. Oh, my God. That part is so funny when he just does that. Oh, it's so subtle, but so good. Anyway.
But this kissing scene, it's very interesting, because we get Alfredo talking about letting go of the nostalgia. But like this kissing reel feels like the embracing of that nostalgia at the same time. Mm-hmm. Right. Whereas like. And I really like that aspect of the film, where it's telling you, you can let go, like let go, move on, don't look back, keep moving forward. But every once in a while, you kind of just have to sit there and watch this reel of the past and mm-hmm. just take it in for what it is and the beauty that it is, because it happened. Like, we look at our lives and there are so many ups and downs in them, good things, bad things. But in the end, we can sit here now and just like look at them and be like, yeah, that happened. Mm-hmm. And like reflect on it and use it to build ourselves. And that's what this kissing scene invokes in me, is you're seeing these kisses and you're rattling off all the movies they're from. And then you're remembering the moments where you watch those movies. And it, like, it just makes you feel like a kid again. It has that uplifting feeling of something bigger than us, right? Like that immortality of film.
Yeah, and I think it brings to Toto a remembrance of what got him involved in all of this in the first place. Mm-hmm. Like what it was that made his life so great, and what it was that made his relationship with Alfredo so meaningful, and why he fell in love with film, and why, you know, as he's walking around, I mean, to me, one of the best parts of this movie is when he does go back to the town and they're going for Alfredo's funeral, and he starts looking around at all the people and they're just older now. And gone off, and he's lived this grand life. And I, the one guy that gets me, and John, you know, I love these little moments, because I talked about it with Breaking Away, with the one character who looks around for somebody to hug and there's nobody there. But the one that gets me in this moment is the guy who recognizes him, but isn't sure.
Yeah.
And never talk in the movie. They never do anything, but he looks at him and you see it register in his head. Like, I think I know him, but I don't. And same thing with Toto. He looks at him. He's like, I think I know him, but I don't. And it's so beautiful because, you know, like Alfredo says to him, you go away and the thread breaks. And when you come, it takes you years to come back and find your people. And what I think that really is, it takes you years to come back to find your appreciation for everybody and for everything. Because when you're in it all the time, then you come back, you think it's going to be the same, and it's not the same. But when you've removed yourself enough from it, and now you come back, and you're not expecting it to be the same, but there are things that are still the same, that's when you start to realize, okay, like, life has continued on here, mm-hmm. just like it's continued on for me, wherever I was. And I don't know, I just, it's a very emotional movie. And like, when you look at my top 20 movies, Eternal Sunshine is a very emotional movie, obviously, and Lost in Translation. But this movie is just so, there's so many different emotions that are experienced while watching this movie. And like you said, you cried during the scene where it's like movies as a religion. I laughed because the priest is blessing the cinema purchased by the mob. Like, I think that is very funny. So, like, there's so many different layers to everything that is taking place, though, but how they all fit into this community, how they're all important to that community, and how even something as annoying as the guy who says, this is my square, you miss him. You see him later in the movie, and he comes walking by and says, this is still my square. Like, it's just... you don't realize the people that you're going to miss. You don't realize the things you're going to miss until you actually leave it and then come back. And then you realize what you're going to miss. I mean, a good example for me was when I left LA. It was during COVID, so it was whatever. We just went back last November, and we drove back by where I used to live, and we got lunch up there at In-N-Out, you know, fancy lunch. But when we went through the street that I lived on, like the strip right off Ventura Boulevard there in Sherman Oaks, I was like, oh my God, every bar survived. Now, when I left in 2020, those bars were all closed because of COVID, but they all managed to make it through COVID. And then I started to say, well, shit, like, I miss this stuff. Like, of course I miss that stuff, but it's never going to be the same as it was in 2018 or 2019 or any of that, because it's beyond that time. It's past that. I'm past that. My friends are past that. Those bars are going to be different than what they were. And how do you capture that feeling on film? Whatever the hell Tornatore did, that's how you capture that feeling on film, whatever he did.
Yeah, I mean, this is a masterful film. It just didn't quite get there for me. Yeah. Like, I honestly thought it was going to, and it just didn't quite get there.
Maybe on your 15th, maybe when you watch this as many times as you've watched all my Whit Stillman movies, you'll finally get there.
I've already watched it as much as I've watched your Whit Stillman movies.
You watched it twice?
Oh, no, I didn't. I forgot I watched Barcelona twice because
you watched Barcelona twice in like a 24-hour period.
Oh, man. Well, it's okay. It's going to happen again. I'm probably going to end up watching it in the next week or two to see how I actually feel about it.
There you go. I love this. Well, you know, Cinema Paradiso, Is just the movie that I'll go back to all the time. And it just hit me, I think, at the perfect time in my life. Like I said, I watched this about 2 days before I moved to Los Angeles because I loved film and all of that stuff. And I remember sitting there and I was watching with my dad, and my dad was like, I just don't get why he would never go home. And, you know, once I went out, you know, I get it. I get it. Once I got out to LA and stuff like that, you know, you spend a week here, a week there, all of that. I get it. Like, I get it. You it's never going to be what it was for you. So you have to somehow move away from it, but how do you move away from it, right? Like, how do you continue to have your life and just talk about it and experience it without going back and, you know, watching things decay and fall apart? Like, that sucks. And so I get it. I get exactly where this guy is coming from as why he never went home for 30 years, why he never went back to that village. But all of those emotions come rushing out of him as soon as he does go back. And it's all amplified by maybe the second greatest score in movie history behind his other one, which was Once Upon a Time in the West. I mean, the score in this movie by Morricone is ridiculous, and it elevates everything so much because, like, how, like, if you were to say to me, what does nostalgia sound like? It sounds like this score. Like, and I don't know how you do that.
This score almost feels like a composite of different film scores. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it feels every note feels like it's a quote of something and you should know what it's quoting, mm-hmm. but you can't quite put your finger on it. And I think that's why it excels so much at just evoking these feelings of nostalgia.
No, and that's a great way to put it. Like, it's quoting other things because you feel like you've heard it your whole life, but you haven't. And, you know, I was saying to you the other day, in Once Upon a Time in the West, the first time the main theme of Once Upon a Time in the West plays, she is riding in a horse-drawn carriage. That is it. She is riding in a horse-drawn carriage, and yet Morricone makes it feel so epic. And we have that same moment where you get that really nostalgic music when they show the square the first time. And it is just beautiful. And you are making beauty out of, if that music wasn't there, it is a mundane shot. It is something maybe you do a puzzle of, but there's nothing groundbreaking about it by any means. But Morricone just elevates it so much with his score. And this score doesn't change that much throughout. A lot of movie scores will, you know, there's a lot of different songs mm-hmm. that go through it. This one is a lot of the same variation of the same score, which I think is important to the movie because the movie is all about reminiscing and nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, keeping that theme persistent throughout it is very important, and just like doing those slight variations on it. And by doing variations, you kind of play with nostalgia as well, right? Like the mm-hmm. idea of how we feel about something is based on our reflections of it, and how our reflection of it isn't the exact thing that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For the first portion of this film, I actually found myself really comparing it to Man with a Movie Camera, actually, of all things. Because mm-hmm. it had the same vibes, where it was just like, I am watching people live right now, and that's mm-hmm. all I'm doing. And I...
Go ahead.
I just really appreciated that a lot. Like, once I got over the fact that I was like, okay, like, there are these minor character interactions and stuff, and we're seeing, like, these emotional tidbits and stuff. Like, you know, the scene where Toto walks down the road with his mom, like, and they discuss the fact that his dad just died and stuff like that. It's like, okay, like, these are like character moments, but they don't feel like they're really building much. It felt like I was just observing these people as they were like living mm-hmm. life.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's a lot of that, like voyeurism kind of going on in this. And I think the reason for that is because it is very clear that this is being told immediately from memory by Toto. It is his memories. Yeah. And so he's going to remember specific things about specific people, but he's not going to remember everything about them. He's not going to know who they actually hung out with, who they were talking to, all of these things. So I think that's why they are so sparse, and they are kind of just going about their everyday stuff, because for Toto, they didn't matter. He didn't care. He didn't know what they were doing.
Exactly. And you know what? Think about your life. You probably feel the same way about most people back then too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are so many people you share memories with and you just don't even know it.
I know, right? That they think about the same thing that we're thinking about right now, you know? It's crazy. I mean, it really is. It's funny because we do that all the time, because, you know, I have like a really tight core group of friends that I grew up with that I still talk to like every day. mm-hmm. we'll just like, we'll say something. And then we'll just joke and be like, you think that person's actually thinking about us right now? Do you think they're in a group chat talking about us right now? Like, and that stupid thing that we're talking about, like, it's just funny to think about that kind of stuff and where that fits in. And, you know, you get so caught up in yourself, right? The way we see Toto do it, that you forget everybody else doing it. And a great line in this movie is, oh, I'm not tired. It's only an hour flight. And she says, after all these years, don't say that. Because it's just for a mother to hear that is so devastating because he got so caught up in his own stuff. He didn't even think, okay, it's only an hour flight. I can go home anytime. He couldn't even do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cinema Paradiso, I don't know. It hits me every time. And one of those movies I watched at the perfect time in my life for me to have that perfect first memory of it. And it's never going to go down for me. You know, there's just going to have to be nothing but there's going to have to be 84 more masterpieces in the world for this one to drop out of my top 100.
I respect that.
All right, so that's all we got for tonight. Next week, we are jumping into the 20-teens, so last decade, although one of the movies just fell out of last decade, John, as scary as that, it is now officially 11 years old. We're going to be talking about Her from 2013, and a movie that I am predicting John will hate with a passion just so that he will go and give it a good review on Letterboxd to prove me wrong, which is Everybody Wants Some from 2016. I really want you to dislike it, John. You're going to hate it. I'm telling you, and I'm trying to use enough reverse psychology that you'll end up surprising me and loving this next week.
It's a Linklater film. I'm not going to dislike it.
I don't know, man. It's a Hangout movie, and I've seen you with Hangout movies so far. So
I've come around on Hangout movies.
We'll see, John. But anyway, so Her from 2013, Everybody Wants Some from 2016. Two movies that are, I think, while they're not nearly as far apart as Cinema Paradiso and Evil Dead 2, and they're not as similar as like two movies by the same director, I think they have a lot of themes in common with each other. And I think that they'll be fun watches, but, you know, always fun to watch somebody fall in love with their cell phone. And that seemed groundbreaking in 2013. And we were like, oh my God, that's actually where people are going. And now everything in our house can answer us, which is really disturbing. You know, and what would my Amazon Alexa look like in a miniskirt, right, John? That's what we're all wondering. So, anyway, top 15 right around the corner. Very excited about that. And it's going to be two movies from the 20 teens that are, you know, similar and not similar and evoke two different emotions. Because one of them is just about getting hammered in college. And one of them is about being lonely.
We're going to be really sad and lonely.
Woo! Yeah. And then we follow that up with Mirror, which is about happy things, right? It's not at all depressing.
Yes. Yes. Tarkovsky film. Definitely happy.
Yeah, we're in the home stretch here. I just want to give everybody a quick preview of like what's coming up. Her and Everybody Wants Some next week, then Mirror in Chinatown, then Fargo and Dr. Strangelove, then Baby Driver and Psycho, then The Road, which I'm very excited to watch again because I'm also curious how John ended up with that at number 11, and Boogie Nights. And then we start the top 10 with Mulholland Drive and Casablanca. So like it's a gauntlet from here on out. So, you know, tell your friends, tell your wife, tell your kids, tell your husband, make sure everybody's sitting here watching this. And that's it. We'll see everybody next week.